ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 10th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, climate talks get underway in Brazil as COP30 attempts to find climate consensus. And how one remote community is successfully tackling youth crime using hot food, basketball, and games of Uno.
Not being judgmental or anything, just letting them come in and feeling safe.
Yeah, and I like the local place to play basketball, you know.
We have built healthy relationships, shared stories, laughed hard, felt shame, had dinner together.
Veteran radio broadcaster John Laws has died, aged 90. The man dubbed the Golden Tonsils spent a remarkable 7 decades on air before finally retiring last year. He was both influential and controversial, leaving a significant legacy behind. He's being remembered across political, media and celebrity circles, as Tanya Dendrinos reports.
Hello world, this is John Laws.
He was one of the most recognisable voices in Australian talkback radio. John Laws was known as the Golden Tonsils.
I always have considered the microphone to be my friend, and I like to think that when I'm talking to the microphone.
But in reality, he spoke to an audience far beyond, interviewing 17 prime ministers during his tenure. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese wrote, John Laws was an iconic voice and so much more, while former Prime Minister John Howard said it was a pleasurable as well as combative experience to be interviewed by John. Mike Baird is a former New South Wales Premier.
He was someone that asked the tough questions, but he did it in a way that was fair. And, I just always had this deep sense of his love for Sydney, for his love for Australia, and every single moment was about trying to make it better.
Radio host Carl Sanderlands posted, John Laws was one of the true originals, while actor and longtime neighbour Russell Crowe described him as a wise mentor, a mischievous mate and a very good friend. Broadcaster Steve Price is a former colleague.
He was one of a kind and I don't think we'll ever see anything like that again.
Still, he acknowledges they clashed at times.
In the dying days of his radio career on 2UE, we weren't rating particularly well, and part of that he blamed me for, part of that he blamed himself. We had our arguments, but I would go to lunch with John Laws every day of the week. He was such an entertaining person. He had such extraordinary stories, and he loved life.
But before transforming talkback, John Laws was a DJ, beginning his career in 1953. John Lyons is now the ABC's America's editor, but in 1991 he wrote an unauthorised biography of John Laws. He says it was the Labor Party that played a pivotal role in shaping his career.
The right wing of the Labor Party, in fact, were the ones who cultivated him, spotted him as an opportunity to try to get their message to the broader community.
The idea was to bypass the press gallery in Canberra, and it caught on both sides of politics.
Paul Keating once said, if you educate John Laws, you educate Middle Australia. I don't think John Laws was a particularly political animal, but he loved the access. There was a quid pro quo there that they would give him, John Howard, Bob Hawke, Paul Keating, Neville Rann, would give him exclusive interviews more than anybody else in the Australian media in return for him giving what they said was a fair go.
His career wasn't without controversy, including the 1999 Cash for Comment scandal.
I think the whole Cash for Comment period was very harmful for John Laws and also for Alan Jones, because the emails that came to light during that period, during the official inquiry, showed that these two broadcasters, the two most influential broadcasters, were doing all sorts of side deals with these different companies, and then would go on air and talk about these companies. Now, both of them said, well, it had nothing to do with us getting the money. But of course, then that raises the question, then why do these companies need to be paying you all this money if this is your opinion anyway?
Do you think that's how he's now going to be remembered?
I think John Laws will be remembered for a lot of things. He was an extraordinary broadcaster. I saw him in action for many occasions. He was a great communicator, but I think the Cash for Comment issue will always be a part of the legacy of John Laws.
After more than 70 years on air, John Laws hung up the headphones for the second and final time last year. In a statement, his family said he died peacefully at home on Sunday. In part, it read, while fame and prominence had become a mainstay of his life, for us, he was always the person who meant so much, away from the microphone, the cameras and the headlines.
Tanya Dendrinos. The BBC has been rocked by an unprecedented crisis at the UK's public broadcaster. Overnight, the scandal claimed its Director General, Tim Davey, and its Chief Executive Officer, Deborah Turness. It all came to a head over allegations the BBC's Panorama programme misrepresented a speech by US President Donald Trump about the January 6 riots. Mr. Trump also has weighed in, calling it corrupt and dishonest. Nicole Johnston has more.
It is a political earthquake at the BBC.
We start with breaking news. The BBC's Director General, Tim Davey, and the CEO of News, Deborah Turness, have both announced their resignations.
Taken down by its own journalism, the BBC has been accused of failing to be impartial in the network's flagship investigative programme, Panorama.
The BBC has come under fire over a Panorama report that was accused of misleading editing on a speech by Donald Trump that made it look like he was urging people to attack the US Capitol.
So how did this all come to pass? Adam Bolton is a British political commentator and broadcaster.
The controversial element is that in a montage with music over January the 6th, the events of January the 6th, 2021, when there was the violent storming of the US Capitol, they put two clips from Donald Trump's hour-long speech. One of them was saying, we're going to march on the Capitol. What Donald Trump said subsequent to that was,
I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard.
That was not included in the clip. Instead, the BBC took a clip from later on in his speech when he said, we're going to have to fight, fight, fight.
We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
So the suggestion is that the BBC distorted what he said and made it as if he was egging on people to fight at Capitol Hill.
Do you think this downfall at the absolute top of the BBC was necessary to try and right the ship?
No, I don't. However, we have to see this in the current cultural war context. And it was clear that Donald Trump and the White House had picked up on this to attack the BBC, to accuse it of fake news. So I think it's impossible to deny that there was a political motive. And my feeling is that in the present climate, where we have seen Donald Trump use his power to take on media organizations who he believes have been critical of him, including America's CBS and ABC America, not your own organization, and to get damages from them and to threaten them in various ways. It is quite possible that the BBC felt that sacrificing their two most senior people in the news chain might actually be a way of averting an overt attack or even a legal suit.
Posting on his social media platform, President Trump described the BBC leaders as very dishonest people who tried to step on the scales of a presidential election. BBC Director General Tim Davey said it was his decision to quit. Head of News Deborah Turness said the buck stops with me and also resigned.
All these problems have enabled those who criticise the very existence of the BBC to pile in on the BBC, and, you know, they've got two very major sculpts tonight.
British political commentator and broadcaster Adam Bolton, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. The Philippines has been hit by its biggest typhoon in years. Super typhoon Fung Wong made landfall on Sunday, less than a week after a state of emergency was declared, following another typhoon, Kalmagi, which left hundreds of people dead in the Philippines before it moved on to Vietnam. Fung Wong has left at least two people dead, and a million people had to be evacuated from its path, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Whipped by wind and rain, rescuers from the Filipino Coast Guard help a woman into the back of a truck in Quezon province in the east of the Philippines. Further south in the province of Sorsogon, another rescue team carries an injured man from his home into the back of a waiting ambulance. Super Typhoon Fun Wong made landfall on the northeastern coast of the Philippines on Sunday, bringing winds of up to 230 kilometres per hour. Ella Mage is a journalist in Manila. She says there's a flood risk across large parts of the country, especially in the north.
Storm surges as high as 3 metres have been lashing on seawalls along the coastlines. We could see debris, houses being swept, and boats being dragged out from the shorelines.
More than 1 million people were evacuated before Fun Wong hit, and a state of emergency was already in place due to extensive damage caused by Typhoon Kalmagi, which hit the Philippines last week. Benison Estrella is a meteorologist with PAGASA, the Philippine Atmospheric Geophysical and Astronomical Services Administration.
Yes, it's very unfortunate, and during this time of the year, we are experiencing these kinds of tropical cyclones, strong typhoons, even super typhoons. The very key here is preparation and awareness.
More than 200 people were killed in the Philippines during Typhoon Kalmagi, and a further 5 died in Vietnam. Filipino-Australians have been gravely concerned by the 2 storms hitting in rapid succession. The Northern Territory Filipino Association President, Emcile Wills, says adequate preparation isn't possible for many people.
The problem is 15.5% of the Filipinos live below the poverty line. We don't have any cyclone, typhoon coded buildings. And if there was, no one can afford anyway. So the level, the definition of preparedness is different from how we prepare here in Darwin, right? Cyclone season is wet season right now. Months before the cyclone, we have cyclone cleanup. There's none of that in the Philippines. Maybe an extra nail on the rooftop, that's how they prepare for cyclones because no one can afford.
The Philippines experiences around 20 typhoons each year. Fun Wong is now the 21st in 2025. Liz Ritchie is a professor of atmospheric sciences at Monash University.
Unfortunately, it's not really an unusual year. The Philippines do tend to get a lot of tropical cyclones passing through them or very, very, very close to them.
But Professor Ritchie says 2 major storms in a week is much less common.
There's been no time to recover from the first typhoon, and that just makes it so much harder to deal with the second one coming through.
While there's no evidence there's been any increase in the number of typhoons or other tropical storms, Professor Ritchie says climate change is likely altering their impact.
Under climate change, you know, we have a warmer atmosphere and a warmer ocean, and that means the atmosphere can hold more moisture. And tropical cyclones convert that moisture into rain. And so we see more rain falling as a result. But we also see these systems perhaps slowing down a little bit on average. And that means that they spend more time over the same location. Not only are they maybe raining a little bit harder than they used to, but they also have more time to put that rain on the ground.
Professor Liz Ritchie from Monash University, ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Well, in the current economic climate, Australian businesses are feeling the squeeze. Wages are up, operating costs are high, and global supply chains are increasingly unpredictable. That's particularly acute for small businesses. According to a new report from the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, those working conditions are prompting many small businesses to reconsider their options. Julia Bergen prepared this story.
Rising costs, more red tape, and dwindling supply of materials needed to make her products. These are just some of the things chocolatier Yasmin Koh says are crippling her small regional New South Wales business.
We're facing these rising costs, but in terms of managing those costs, it's not as simple as just passing it on to the consumer, because in this tough economic environment, we understand that consumers are more stretched than they've ever been, and that they're also having to make really tough spending decisions.
In the past year, Yasmin Koh says her artisan chocolate company, Sweet Pea and Poppy, has been hard hit, leaving her no option but to cut down on the variety of chocolates she makes.
It's heartbreaking having to remove a product from a line, but we've had to take a really disciplined and really tough approach to what we can continue to do and what, unfortunately, we can no longer do because it's just not viable for us.
It's a similar story for Louise Ridlin, who says profits at a small Sydney-based IT company are getting lower, staffing costs higher and cash flow tighter.
I guess I probably once a month say, why am I doing this? And the rest of the month I can see we have a purpose and we have a mission and we do good work, and so I can keep myself motivated to do that. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard as a small business owner to be consistently taking that risk yourself, ensuring that the company does well.
These experiences are common. There are 2.5 million small businesses in Australia, which employ about 5 million people. And today, the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry has released a report on the working conditions of more than 1,100 of them. Almost half say they're highly stressed, and nearly a third have considered shutting up shop in the past year.
It's rising costs, so we're seeing things like rent and energy, of course, being at the top of that list. The compliance burden, so struggling with red tape.
Andrew McKellar heads the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
It's particularly severe for small business, and I think we need to see concerted action from government and from the business sector to really try and address those compliance pressures.
60% of survey respondents say they're spending more than $20,000 on legal compliance. In addition to domestic pressure points, there's also international ones, things like tariffs and trade barriers. Although those economic conditions are making life tough for types of companies, University of New South Wales economist Richard Holden says it's most pronounced for small businesses.
Small businesses typically, you know, operate with less of a safety net than big businesses do. They don't have big balance sheets, and so relatively modest size hits to their bottom line can have outsized effects.
Richard Holden fears more small businesses will fold, owners and workers will suffer, and Australia's productivity will take a huge hit if nothing changes.
It's often small and medium-sized enterprises that are able to move swiftly, grab new opportunities, move fast in the face of, say, new technologies or new global trends. And if people see a lot of small businesses doing it tough or even failing, you know, I think it's much less likely that people are going to want to have a go and start up a small business. So I think it has a real hit on innovation as well.
UNSW economist Richard Holden ending that report by Julia Bergen. A trade fair for the fossil fuel industry, or a last-ditch effort to turn emissions around. A trimmed-down COP30 begins in Brazil today, and the good news is that the Paris Agreement is working. The bad news is that it's just not working fast enough. This climate conference is being held in Belém, at the gateway to the threatened Amazon rainforest, in the very nation where the UN Climate Convention was first signed back in 1992. Wesley Morgan is a research associate at the Institute for Climate Risk and Response at UNSW Sydney, and he joined me earlier. Wesley, tell me, what's at stake at this COP in Brazil?
Well, look, COP30 is a really pivotal moment for the world. So this year's UN climate talks comes 10 years after the landmark Paris Agreement. And in the past decade, countries have together taken big strides in limiting global emissions, and the clean energy transition is now well underway and accelerating. But we also see geopolitical headwinds are growing, and the damage bill for the climate pollution is rising. So climate action really hangs in the balance. And this year's talks, the question is, will the world double down on the clean energy transition, or will momentum stall and fossil fuel interests win out?
We as a nation are not the climate laggards we used to be. It might be fair to call the US that now, having pulled out of the Paris Agreement. But what can Australia do in terms of a contribution at this COP?
Australia actually has a really outsized role to play at this year's UN climate talks. So we have our 2035 target. You see, the way the Paris Agreement works is that countries have agreed to limit global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees. And to get there, all countries need to set national targets every 5 years. And that's why this year is so incredibly important, because new targets are due. And so if we're to continue the momentum in tackling the climate crisis, we want to see all the world's big economies setting strong targets to reduce emissions, and that sends a signal as to where the world is headed. And unfortunately, we're seeing momentum stall in North America, and with war in Europe, we're seeing momentum slow there as well. And Australia, we're an important middle power developed country, and we have set a 2035 target that compares favorably with most of the developed world. And so this helps to maintain global momentum. Our 2035 target measures up well against all developed countries. There's only a handful that have set stronger targets than ours.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's attracted a little bit of criticism over his decision to not attend this COP30 in Brazil. Australia is bidding to host COP31 in Adelaide. Turkey is a competitor and has refused to withdraw that rival bid. But what would it mean for Australia to host such an event on our home soil?
Oh, it would be huge. So hosting the UN climate talks would be the biggest diplomatic summit that Australia has ever hosted. And, you know, successfully hosting COP31 would be an opportunity for Australia to manage our economic stake in the global energy transition. If we plan to host the UN climate talks in partnership with Pacific Island countries, and so it would be an opportunity to cement our place in our region with Pacific nations, tackling the issue that they see as key to their survival. It would be an opportunity to grow new green energy exports, which over time is going to be needed to replace declining demand for Australian coal, gas, and iron ore. So hosting the UN climate talks next year would be really crucial for Australia's economic and strategic interests.
There are plenty to come out of Brazil in the next 2 weeks. Wesley Morgan is a research associate at the Institute for Climate Risk and Response at UNSW Sydney. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Keeping kids off the street and out of trouble is a pretty common problem without many solutions. But in Western Australia's far north, one town is celebrating the success of their community-led program. Dunya Karagic has this story.
As the sun sets in Fitzroy Crossing in WA's far north, children run around in the golden hour as families listen to speeches marking a milestone.
We listen to our young people's voices and have worked with them to create a space that they told us what they need for this community.
They're celebrating the one-year anniversary of an important youth hub called the Night Space, run by the community's Marawarrawarra Aboriginal Corporation. Speaking to the crowd, Youth Connections Program Manager Rochelle Dolby says it's been life-changing.
We have built healthy relationships, shared stories, laughed hard, felt shame, had dinner together, and we got to know more about our language, family and culture.
In that time, more than 600 children, like 13-year-old Josia, have walked through the doors, accessing a safe space where they can play activities and get a meal after dark.
Yeah, and I love the local place to play basketball, you know.
Night Space cook Saraya Middleton has helped serve more than 20,000 meals to children here. She's one of a number of community members who say this program has helped significantly in reducing youth crime.
It's just broke the cycle. Back in the days when we were young, the kids back then used to do this break-in and thing. Now there's the Night Place, it increases the crime in Fitzroy, the robbing around the town, it got less. We're just so proud.
Fitzroy Crossing Police Station's officer in charge, Senior Sergeant Mark Howe, has noticed the large drop in crime.
As a police officer, we often see the darker side of life, which is why being even a small part of something as good as the Night Space, it's good for the soul. Since its inception, we've seen a significant reduction in stolen motor vehicles and burglaries.
WA police say in the year before the program began, there were 74 offences for stealing a car, which dropped to 35 since the program. However, these figures don't identify how many were committed by children. Night Space worker Lionel Ma grew up in Fitzroy Crossing and says the program uses local staff and that helps build connections with the children.
Not being judgmental or anything, just, you know, opening the front gates and stuff and letting them come in and, you know, feeling safe.
Meanwhile, 1,000 kilometres away, Kununurra is grappling with a surge in juvenile offending, with 30 children recently arrested for a spate of alleged stolen vehicle and reckless driving incidents. With a Night Space opening there next year, it's hoped the town will see a drop in crime too. Speaking at the anniversary, former WA Attorney General John Quigley says Fitzroy Crossing is a role model for other towns.
Fitzroy Crossing community is showing the way. You cannot arrest your way out of a social problem. It's up to the community to wrap their arms around those in need.
And while not all children at the anniversary are regular attendees of the night space, they all had one simple message.
Keen supporters of the Youth Hub Night Space. Ending that report by Dunya Karagic. And that's all from The World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. You may or may not have noticed in the corner of a shopping centre or in a convenience store, the crypto ATM. There are thousands of them, which makes sense because there's a crypto boom. Today, business reporter Rhianna Whitson on how they're increasingly being used to scam innocent Australians out of millions of dollars. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.